so much happening in Israel, talk of a third temple, talk of a new Sanhedrin. How should we respond to it as followers of Jesus, Yeshua?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are right now in the time period between the Day of Atonement, the 10th day on the 7th month of the biblical calendar, and the Feast of Tabernacles, which is celebrated over a one-week period, Sukkot in Hebrew. It is a time of repentance, now going into a time of celebration. The question is, how do we receive atonement? There's no temple standing, no sacrifices being offered. Lots of questions in the air these days. This is Michael Brown. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have a Jewish-related question for me and my guest who'll be joining me from Israel, a Jewish-related question, Israel-related question of any kind, Hebrew-related, Jewish tradition, something concerning Israel and the surrounding nations today, by all means, give us a call, 866-348-7884, 866-34-TRUTH. Without further ado, I want to bring on the air one of my dear, dear friends for many, many years, living in Israel with his Israeli wife for many, many years, Ron Cantor, and he leads Messiah's Mandate Ministries. He's also a key leader in a key congregation in Tel Aviv, Tiferet Yeshua. Hey, Ron, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Doing real, real well. So, Ron, just quickly, You're about 10 years younger than me, and you have stayed physically active and done athletic events. What did you do most recently and why?
Well, I swam across the Sea of Galilee. I was going to walk across.
I was going to walk, yeah.
I try and be like Jesus as much as possible, but I'm not quite yet there. But every year in September, about 10,000 Israelis swim 3.5 kilometers across the Sea of Galilee, and I try and do it with them.
And you did it.
I did do it. Yes, I barely did it this year.
Ah, all right, getting a little tougher.
A little bit tougher as the years go by. I was actually a bit dehydrated because you can't drink, even though you're in water. You can't drink water for about 2 hours, and by the time I finished, I was really exhausted. But we do it to raise funds for our work here in Israel. We raised about $6,500 for our congregation in Tel Aviv. So even though it was hard and difficult and I was exhausted, it was worth it for what we're doing here in the land.
Well, you know, you're so much more productive with your exercise time because I sit and row and do other workouts, and we don't raise any money for missions and Jewish work, so I'm gonna have to figure out something, just a dollar for every row or something like that on the rowing machine. Hey, Ron, in all seriousness, though, this is a very special time on the biblical calendar, and for the nation of Israel, even though many Israelis are secular, this is the Israeli calendar. So you don't have Christmas, you don't have Thanksgiving, but you do have the biblical holidays and holy days. So what's the atmosphere like in Israel on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement?
Well, it's mixed because you have secular Israelis and you have religious Israelis. And when I say religious, even in that group, you have many different types of religious, from the ultra-Orthodox to the traditional. But on Yom Kippur, the entire nation shuts down. There are no stores open. There are no restaurants open. You can't go get milk for your coffee. You can't get coffee. It's closed. The roads shut down. The religious Jews, they go to synagogue all day long, and they pray, and they fast, and they hope that the nation will be forgiven of its sin, while the secular Jews, some fast because it's tradition, but there'll be hundreds of thousands of people, really, on the streets because there's no cars. You'll have teenagers biking down the interstate. You have parents with their children on their, you know, little toys, you know, go-karts all over the roads of Tel Aviv, and it's really quite something to see. So you have two different worlds celebrating in two different ways. Not celebrating, but observing in two different ways.
Got it. And do you get to interact much with religious Jews and find out about how they feel after Yom Kippur? Have you been able to do that, maybe not immediately after, but talking to them months or years down the line? Just how do you feel every year? Do you feel forgiven? Have you had those dialogues?
I haven't really, because our ministry is primarily in Tel Aviv, which is a very secular city. I happen to be in Jerusalem right now, which is a much more religious area. But I can tell you that before I was a believer, I remember literally about a month before I gave my life to Yeshua, to Jesus, I fasted on Yom Kippur in hopes of being forgiven of my sin. And I can tell you that I sincerely fasted and did not feel, I felt very hungry at the end of 24 hours. And I discovered, Mike, that the Bible never promises that we would be forgiven for our sins because we fast. The entire passage, Leviticus 16, about the Day of Atonement is not really about fasting at all. There's two minor mentions about denying ourselves, but the whole focus of the passage is about a sacrifice. There would be the scapegoat, and there would be the goat that sacrificed. But again, as you mentioned earlier on the broadcast, there's no more temple, so there's no more sacrifice. So now we just fast. But fasting really, that's a human work. There's no atonement in fasting. The idea of atonement is that someone else suffers for your sins. In our case, Yeshua was the once for all time, for all sin sacrifice. But fasting was merely the act of humility that we would come to the Lord with our sacrifice in hopes that he would receive it.
Yeah, and last night on our Real Messiah broadcast, which blankets New York City and then goes by internet around the world, we talked about these very things. We looked at what was at the center of the Day of Atonement and what is conspicuously missing today. Well, with all that, Ron, there are some religious Jews who are active in a movement wanting to rebuild a third temple and reconstitute a Sanhedrin, a Jewish leadership. They're not necessarily the same groups, but there's a lot of overlap between them. And a lot of Christians get very excited, you know, prophecy being fulfilled, and this is going to be exciting. And you and I, as Jewish believers in Jesus, especially you living in Israel, we have a little bit different perspective. So let's back up and talk about a few things. Recently, there was a major event put together by this new Sanhedrin, and it was going to be a creation concert celebrating creation, and it was going to have people there from different faiths, and Christians were there as well. And I talked about it on the air and said, I don't know exactly what to make of this, because on the one hand, it seemed to be very open and saying, listen, we are broad-based and we are welcoming followers of Yeshua here. On the other hand, if there really is a new Sanhedrin, I expect it'll be very similar to what we read in the Gospels and Acts, that this will be a leadership that ultimately persecutes people like you and me. So what's your take living there in Israel?
Well, it's very much similar to Paul's. If you read Paul in Romans chapter 10, he says his heart's desire is for Israel, that they would be saved. That's my heart's desire for these rabbis, for these religious Jews. I don't hate them. I'm not mad at them. I love them. I cry for them. I so long for them to know the Lord. Paul was so broken up about their state that in Romans 9, he said he'd be willing to trade his salvation if only his brothers, the Israelites, would know the Lord. So I preface what I'm about to say by saying I have nothing but love. Even when they persecute us and lie about us and you know, try and destroy our buildings or hurt us, you know, Yeshua said that we should rejoice when we are persecuted. It's not always easy. But having said that, I'm certainly concerned. You know, there is a group here. I didn't really know about it. You said that in believers of Yeshua were welcome to come. Well, I think they primarily mean evangelical Gentile believers. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were inviting any Jewish believers in Jesus from Israel to come. They still pretty much hate us, consider us a cult. And now, if you remember, during the New Testament time, we read about a group called the Sanhedrin, 71 Jewish judges. They had real power. They had real authority. They were kind of your religious police system, judicial system. And so here we are now in the, what I believe, the end of times. And suddenly there's a new group that they're calling themselves the Sanhedrin. Of course, you know, they're just 71 guys calling themselves the Sanhedrin. There's no, they have no real authority with the religious court system in Israel. And this is not that. This is 71 religious Jews who they want to see the Messiah come. They want to see world peace. They believe that Jerusalem is significant and that the UN should move to Jerusalem and should be run by these 71, the new Sanhedrin. Here's the concern I have. You know, they had this concert a few weeks ago. They invited believers, and I don't know exactly how many, but there were pastors from the United States of America. And some of them were amazed. They were saying things like, these guys are going to play a powerful role in the end times. I have yet to find any prophecy that speaks of a new Sanhedrin that doesn't believe in Jesus in the end times that's called by God to play a significant role, but this is what they believe. People were enthralled. They said they felt the presence of God. And to be honest with you, Mike, I'm really concerned about this because if there is a new Sanhedrin, and if the third temple, and we're not even there yet, you and I, in this conversation, but if the third temple is actually built, you know, those of us who, you know, believe in the Bible prophecies, Old Testament prophecies, it seems that there's going to be agreement between the religious Jews and the Antichrist for the building of this third temple. And to see all these Christians excited about it, aligning themselves, and that was the call, by the way, at this concert where the Sanhedrin, they were calling these evangelical Christians to align themselves, that was the word used, to align themselves with this new Sanhedrin. For me, it's a little bit scary.
Yeah, and again, I've shared your exact same sentiments the whole way through. I think a great thing for our evangelical Christian friends to say to this Sanhedrin is, all right, first thing you need to do is openly embrace Messianic Jewish leaders in Israel. That's first thing. And say, we welcome you, you who are Jewish followers of Yeshua, we welcome you in our midst. That'd be interesting. Back with Ron Cantor.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. I'm joined for a few more minutes with my dear friend from Israel, Ron Cantor. We've known each other for most of our lives. Since Ron was, I'd say, 18 and I was 28, so now 63, 53, thereabouts. If you've got a Jewish-related question, now is the time to call in, because as soon as I'm done with Ron, I'm going to go to your question. So any Jewish-related question of any kind, give us a call, 866-348-7884. Hey, Ron, really quickly, I want to encourage folks with this testimony. When you moved to Israel, one of your first goals was to learn modern Hebrew and then obviously be able to evangelize and preach and teach in Hebrew. How long did it take you until you were really able to fluently share your faith and or preach publicly?
It took me, my plan was 2 years. Uh-huh. I was going to take off ministry for 2 years, study Hebrew full time, and then in 2 years I'd be fluent preaching, no problem. It took me 7 years. 7 years is when I preached my first message in Hebrew. Now, I did other ministry in English. I was a pastor at King of Kings, a very large English-speaking congregation here. So I had an outlet for ministry, but no, 7 years. At one time, I just asked God, I said, can't you just, in utter desperation, can't you just download Hebrew to me? And he spoke to me, and he said, I could. He said, but you're learning more more than just Hebrew. He was humbling me. He was breaking me. You know, I could preach in front of 100,000 people in Africa and just be chomping at the bit. And then my first message in front of 45 people, I wanted to run and hide. I was just absolutely terrified. It used to take me a whole week just to prepare one message. Now it only takes me a day. But yeah, learning Hebrew has been the greatest challenge of my life.
You know, Ron, the problem with you and me is that we're so full of confidence, it takes God a while to kill the flesh in us. takes him a little longer to humble us because of the self-confidence there. But anyway, yeah, it's a great example of perseverance and going for it and frustration, challenge, but your heart is for your people. And I just want to put a graphic up. I stumbled on this today. I'd seen it, I think, a few years ago. It's a website that asks who's a Jew. And Jew or not Jew. So somehow a link came up with my name there. So I went to look at it. Lists others with the name Mike Brown or Michael Brown. But then it's got a bunch of pictures of all different people named Mike or Michael Brown. And then you click on the picture and it tells you, is this person really Jewish or not? No, not Jewish. Yes, Jewish. Yeah, Jewish hockey player, etc. So when you click on mine, it says, this is Michael Brown, Messianic apologist. He is... forget we ever mentioned him. So everybody else, you click on the name and it comes right up, but not my name. So there is something about us as Messianic Jews where we still have a certain pariah status. And even though congregations are growing, there are thousands of Messianic Jews now as opposed to a handful at the birth of the nation. There still is opposition, and we expect the more religious Jews have power, there'll be more opposition. What just happened in Ashdod that our listeners and viewers should know about?
Yeah, just real briefly, we talked just on our last segment, we talked about the Sanhedrin. If people want to read the article that I wrote about the new Sanhedrin, just go to messiahsmandate.com or .org, messiahsmandate.org. But in Ashdod, you know, my dear friend of mine, Israel Pachter, is a pastor there. He's got a large congregation of 300 believers, Jewish believers, and they have built a brand new building, a beautiful building. God has blessed them. People helped from all over the world. And two Orthodox Jews, and again, I want to preface, we love them. We're here for them. We're trying to reach them. So even when they do things like this, we're not spreading hate. We're spreading love. But they broke into the facility, to the outer court of the facility. It's a gated area, and they spray painted it at least in 10 or 12 different areas in Hebrew. Missionaries are a danger to the nation or a national danger, and just did a lot of destruction to their property. And they consider us, you know, they don't consider us, you know, listen, I'm an Israeli. I have a passport that says I'm an Israeli. I have an identification card that says I'm an Israeli. I'm not a missionary. Missionaries go to other countries. I'm in my own country, and the people of this congregation, they're not missionaries. They're Israelis simply sharing the love of Yeshua to the Jewish nation. But they, you know, they consider us a threat. And it's sad because, you know, again, going back to what Paul said, they don't know. You know, they have a zeal, but it's not according to righteousness. It's not according to faith. And so they damaged the property quite a bit, saying, you know, these missionaries, us, were a national danger.
And what happened? Did the police act on this? Because normally they might be a little slow to act on this. You may have some religious Jews at the police station and others, and
right,
they may be slower to act. What happened this time around?
Well, you know, even in this time around, initially the police were like, well, it's not a big deal. What are we going to do? They don't really, the police don't go out of their way to do what they would do for anyone else. There's a lot of pressure on the police from the Orthodox to not do anything. But this time there was so much evidence because we live in a different time where you can't just walk in and do damage like that and not be videotaped. There's even pictures of these Orthodox Jews taking pictures of themselves with their cell phones, not realizing that they were being recorded the whole time. So when the video evidence was brought to them, and a soldier, an Israeli soldier who's a believer, he was there on the property, he saw them doing what they were doing, He ran after them and videotaped them as well. So when all the evidence was given to the police, they realized that they had to act on it. And so the last I heard is that they are actively looking for the fellows in the videos. And, you know, Israel Pox, the pastor, he's not trying. He doesn't want to press charges. He doesn't want to sue them. He just wants them to clean up the mess that they made. So we'll see what happens with that. But fortunately, this is one of the first times that the police are being forced to act in our favor.
Yeah, and it's, look, 300 members of a congregation, Messianic Jewish congregation, is massive in Israel. In most of the world, it's very large.
Yeah, yeah.
In Israel, it's massive. Having your own building, these are all significant things. And I guess the police are looking for two men wearing black coats and black hats with side curls, which is only about several hundred thousand.
That's about 100,000 people. But fortunately, their faces were revealed. So I think they'll have an easier time finding them. Not to mention, who knows, maybe they posted it on their own Facebook pages because they were so proud of themselves, as so often people do when they commit crimes.
Yeah, and who knows, saying they're caught, when the Messianic Jews don't lash out with anger and hatred, who knows what God will end up doing in their own lives. But this is what we can expect. Look, right now nobody's killing you, but these are the kinds of things we can expect to happen in biblical days. They're happening around the world. We can expect this in the days to come as well. And Ron, when I think about a third temple, I think about the potential of deception. I think of this paving the way for an anti-Messiah. I think of this being further arguments. Well, see, we have blood sacrifices. There go all your arguments about Jesus. So I see that. I do believe scripturally there will be a third temple. But in my mind, if there's an eagerness to see it happen, it's only because I'm eager to see Yeshua return, not because I'm eager to see a third temple.
Right. And what's going to happen, you know, if we read scriptures, the Bible is very clear that the anti-Messiah, the Antichrist, after this, and that the third temple will be erected, I believe. That's how I view biblical prophecy. And sacrifices will be restored, and there will be an Orthodox Jewish revival. My concern is that Christians are getting excited about this.
Yeah.
You know, a Judaism without Jesus is not authentic biblical Judaism. And what's going to happen is 3.5 years roughly after he helps them, the Antichrist helps them build this temple, he's going to then take it over. He's going to set up his own image. He's going to declare himself to be God. So I don't encourage believers to be involved in building a temple that's going to belong eventually to the Antichrist. Now, when Jesus comes back, that's what, you know, these Orthodox Jews who are longing for the rebuilding of the temple, they want the Messiah to come, and he will come. Yeshua will return, and he will come into Jerusalem, and he will be king over all the earth, according to Zechariah chapter 14. But before that, there's going to be a huge confrontation with this anti-Messiah figure, and there's going to be great persecution all over the world. So it does concern me when believers are aligning themselves with Orthodox Jews who don't believe in Yeshua, who actually reject Jewish believers for the rebuilding of this temple. Again, it is a wonderful thing. Let me be really clear. I am so happy that evangelical believers are dialoguing with Orthodox Jews, that they're building friendships and relationships. But ultimately, our commission is not, you know, we weren't given the great dialogue. We were given the great commission to share the good news with everyone, and that includes the Jewish people.
Yeah, and I just need to jump in, Ron. We've just got literally 35 seconds. Friends, go to messiahsmandate.org. Messiah's Mandate, that's Messiah with S, messiahsmandate.org, and help Ron get to that $10,000 he was swimming for to raise funds for the congregation. Here, this aging brother sacrificing his body, almost giving himself in the Sea of Galilee. Can we make it more dramatic? Hey, Ron, do you think you're going to be in Israel the first week of February? Do you know?
I believe I will be.
All right, so listen, friends, if you are part of my Israel tour, February 1st through 10th, there's still just a few days left for you to sign up and join us. Holy Fire in the Holy Land. Great tour by day, special meetings by night. We're going to do our best to get none other than Ron Cantor there in the flesh to speak and minister to you one of the nights that we're there. Hey, Ron, bless you. Thanks for staying up late with us.
Always great to be with you. Good night, everyone. It's late here in Israel. Thank you.
All right. God bless. We'll be right back, friends.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast here on The Line of Fire. Question for you. Does the Bible explicitly say that there will be a future third temple before the Messiah returns? Not the temple that he will build in the millennial kingdom, if you understand scripture as I do, we expect that, but a temple that will be built by the Jewish people before the Messiah returns. The reason I believe there will be is that 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 references that the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, will set himself up in the temple as God. It seems to be speaking of a physical place, and the Thessalonians would have known about the temple in Jerusalem. Matthew 24, with parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21, what's known as the Olivet Discourse, also point to fulfillment of many things when the temple was destroyed in 70, but then other events that still await a future destruction, which we would then say will take place when the Messiah returns. So I do believe there will be a third temple, but I'm not looking for the building of the temple. I'm looking for the fulfilling of the Great Commission. I'm looking for God's people to come together as one in the fullness of the Spirit. I'm looking for Jesus, the Messiah, to return. All right, you've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish-related answers. So let's go to the phones, 866-348-7884, and we'll start in Birmingham, Alabama. Courtney, welcome back to The Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So my question is kind of going to go along the reference of the Second Thessalonians along with the Sanhedrin. So are you aware that they are putting Trump's face on the shekel?
Who, when you say they, who's they?
For the Temple Institute, the Sanhedrin mints the half shekel, which is
mimicked. Yeah, in other words, this is not Israeli currency. This is not anything national or recognized by the nation. This is more of like a souvenir. This is more of a special memento. So that's to recognize President Trump's role in moving the embassy back to Jerusalem, to honor him and to recognize him as a Cyrus kind of figure used by God to bring Jewish restoration, even though Cyrus did not know the Lord. Yeah, they have printed coins with the face of Trump and that reference, so a comparison to a Cyrus kind of figure. Again, more of a souvenir, a memento, a way to honor the president for what he did, but certainly not something that I think that they're saying will have currency use in the future during a time of a third temple.
I guess where my concern comes in is because, from my understanding, they are mimicking it after Exodus 30, in particular verse 15, where it says you are to make atonement for your soul with this shekel.
Yeah, that's not the... Even though the Hebrew word atonement is a proper translation literally, it's talking about a ransom. It's not talking about atonement there of sin. It's talking about a ransom to turn away wrath. When the census is taken and the people of Israel are counted, that is considered to be a dangerous time and a time when people can be subject to wrath and judgment. Hence, the temple tax or the sanctuary tax would be a way to ward off wrath in the case of the counting of the people. So it's not a matter of you get atonement by money. So you have this coin, you use this money to get forgiveness of sins. It's never associated with forgiveness of sins. There's no repentance, no confession of sin. Rather, it's turning away wrath from the people of Israel by their participation in this. So there's no sense where Donald Trump is becoming a spiritual figure or where he's being looked to in some messianic way or there's any type of association like that. I can assure you the coin has nothing to do with that at all. I appreciate your questions, but it certainly has nothing to do with that at all.
Okay, and then the last one is, how do you feel that if this continues, how do you feel it could be used in reference to, I know you believe there's going to be a third temple. I kind of lean more towards a tabernacle, so to speak. How do you feel that could be used, I guess, together by the anti-Messiah?
What, the coin or Trump?
Yeah, just in general, if it if the Sanhedrin takes off and becomes much more accepted, how do you?
Yeah, so, okay, so number one, the seeking to form a coalition of 71 rabbis who will have legal authority over the whole nation, even that they've come together in this way, that is a far, 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 far cry from having any authority over anything but a small group of people, to be honest. There are plenty of different leading rabbis in Israel that the different groups go to, and they are largely broken down between Ashkenazi and Sephardi, and then further subdivisions there. So any notion of a nationally unified group of Jewish rabbis leading the nation is a long ways off. I mean, God could accelerate anything. The bottom could fall out in society. Things can change. But by the time any of that happens, I don't personally think that President Trump is going to be a figure, a leading figure in the midst of what's happening in Israel, just remembered for what he did. But honestly, the biggest thing is how we can witness effectively in the land, how we can pray for the salvation of the Jewish people, and we shall see what happens with these other groups and organizations. But if there is a future Sanhedrin, I expect it to treat Jewish followers of Yeshua the same way the Sanhedrin did in the days of the apostles. Hey, thank you for the very interesting questions. Much appreciated. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Mark in Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Hey, there was a red heifer born in Israel about a week and a half ago. So my question is, how old does the red heifer have to be sacrificed for temple? And then if the temple is not yet erected, then can they preserve the ashes for future use like they did in the Old Testament, where they had 9 red heifers for the thousands of years?
Yeah, so the question of the red heifer, I probably mentioned in brief last week. But I want to first say, as we talk about Third Temple and these kinds of issues, and we're on the biblical calendar now in between the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles, so a time of tremendous activity in the religious Jewish world, and part of the Tabernacles coming up, one of the 3 feasts that God established, and holy celebrations where Jews were to come in from all around the world to the temple in Jerusalem. So there's a lot we think about. Will there be a third temple built? How would it be built and when? But I want to reiterate that your average Israeli, your average secular Israeli, no more thinks about a third temple being built than they think about an invasion from Mars. That's the first thing. Among the religious Jews, the vast, vast majority expect this is something the Messiah will do when he's revealed, and that we get in the way of it when we try to make something happen. So the ones who are really focused on this, to be honest, are primarily evangelical Christians, and then a small group of religious Jews who are working together to prepare for the third temple. So building the lampstand, building the altar for sacrifices, building making the priestly garments, etc. So you cannot have purification unless you have a red heifer without blemish. It is then slaughtered. Now, the Bible talks about it in Numbers 19, does not give the age when it's to be slaughtered, but Jewish tradition says that it's 3 years old when it's slaughtered. So it would have to be without blemish to that point. And the religious Jews who want to see this happen have been working for years with just trying to manipulate however they can the birth of these cows and to see if a red heifer can be produced. So what they would do theoretically would be that at 3 years, they would kill the red heifer, they would burn the ashes, and then they would save the ashes, as you're suggesting, until the temple was actually built and functioning, and then you could have the waters of purification. But without that, technically speaking, the whole Jewish world has been in a state of ritual impurity on a certain level without these. On another level, there are other things done, you know, symbolically to wash and cleanse and receive purification. But yeah, so in the circles following this, it's big news, and we shall see what unfolds in the days ahead.
Okay, so 3 years and they can save the ashes?
Yeah, no reason why they couldn't save the ashes. Nothing says they couldn't.
Okay, well, thank you for the information.
Sure thing. 866-34-TRUTH. If there's something somewhere that you want to show me that ashes can't be saved of a red heifer, burnt while waiting for the building of the temple, feel free to send me the source. 866-348-7884. Let's go over to Stuart in Greensboro, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, my name is Stuart, and I just have a question for clarification, because I know that there was Solomon's temple and then Zerubbabel's temple after the exile, and then Herod built a temple during the time of Christ.
Well, no, Herod expanded Herod expanded the temple that was built under Zerubbabel. Okay. So that's the second temple that was expanded by Herod, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. I just, you know, from history, it seemed like there was three already, and, you know, you're talking about the rebuilding of the third
temple.
Got it.
No, probably others had that thought as well. No, when they mention, for example, in John 2, when Jesus says, kill this temple, I'll destroy this temple, I'll raise it up on the third day, and they thought he was talking about the physical temple, and we've been building this for 46 years. They're talking about all the expansion, all the building out of it, but that was the second temple that then got beautified and massively expanded to become a wonder of the ancient world, as Solomon's temple was under Herod. But no, that was the second temple. So we've got the first temple period, the second temple period, and then we've been without a temple ever since. Hey, friends, let me encourage you, if you've not watched our video, How Did the Church Get Separated from Its Jewish Roots? It's really, really relevant. Been viewed, probably about 150,000 times on our YouTube channel. You can watch it. Just go to our website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org/consider this. And you'll see the video, How Did the Church Get Cut Off from Its Jewish Roots? It's also on the Ask Dr. Brown YouTube channel, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Rhonda in the Bronx. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Welcome. How are you doing, sir?
I'm blessed. Thank you.
May God be the glory. Just want to ask a question. I am a born-again believer, and, in the last days, and I just wanted to know, if the shofar blowing, how often can you do that over your family and over your life? And, you know, I just wanted to ask that question.
Yeah, sure. Hey, Rhonda, there are a few times in Scripture where the shofar is to be blown at specific times. But as far as something you do in worship, as far as something you do in spiritual warfare, sky's the limit. There's no number put on it. Whatever works well between you and the Lord and your family and doesn't wake the neighbors. All right, thanks for the question.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Shout, shouts of joy, and victory resound in the tents of the righteous of the Lord.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire here. My friend Paul Wilbur singing just puts joy in my own heart. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. A few more minutes for your Jewish-related questions. I just want to throw something out quickly. And Matt, this is going to be the first time you'll hear me talking about this, but there is an infamous video that's gone viral on YouTube by Pastor Steven Anderson called Marching to Zion. It's as anti-Semitic as they get. And folks have asked me over the last year or so, have I thought about putting out a video refuting it? And on the one hand, you hate to even deal with some of the drivel that's in it. On the other hand, people are deceived by it. On the other hand, often the ones being deceived by it could care less about truth and facts and information because there's extreme bias and hatred in their hearts already. But you reach who you can reach and help those as best you can help those that are open and seeking. The problem is to do it right would take a lot of time. In other words, there's so much error in it, there's so much deception in it, that to really unpack it properly does take a lot of time. And I'm thinking about doing it. We might need some funding to do it right, where we really present things in full, in depth, and even with animation and things like that. But we shall see. But suffice it to say, someone pointed out to me on social media that they're now having a conference, a Marching to Zion conference, and among the things stated in it is, if you hate Judaism, this is the conference for you. Listen, friends, it is a very, very short jump from hating Judaism to hating Jews. Okay? Let me say it again. It's a very short jump. It's not even a jump. It's not even a leap. It's just a lean from hating Judaism to hating Jews. So beware. We're going to see a rising tide of anti-Semitism among professing Christians. It will raise its ugly head yet again. And those of us who love Jesus and love the Jewish people, even in their state of separation from the Messiah, we will have to stand against this yet again. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Dwayne in Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. My question is about the last invasion of Israel, the Gog and Magog War. It says that we will be reigning as priests with Christ for 1,000 years. After 1,000 years, Satan will be released and the countries will come against Israel. How is it that they're coming against Israel when Christ is supposed to be reigning? Do they not see him? Do they not know his power, even though he's there? How does that work out?
Yeah, my understanding is Ezekiel 38 and 39 are before the millennial kingdom, before Yeshua returns and sets up his kingdom and rules and reigns, okay? So the imagery of an invasion and attack can be used in other places, all right? But my understanding is that Gog and Magog, that takes place at the end of this age as there is an attack against Israel. That's also spoken of in Zechariah 12 and Zechariah 14. And it's God also bringing the nations together for judgment, all right? Then the Messiah returns, destroys the wicked, establishes his kingdom on the earth with Israel playing a central role and with us as believers ruling and reigning together with him. And then at the end of that period, Revelation chapter 20 states this. Again, so I understand this to be after the 1,000-year reign. It says Satan's chained up in the abyss, right? It's locked and sealed over him so he could not deceive the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were over. So now when you go down to verse 7, when 1,000 years are over, the adversary will be set free from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. So it's 100% natural, sir, to look at the text just the way you did, that Ezekiel 38, 39, Gog and Magog, that is after the millennium. I simply understand that as the whole book of Revelation is drawing on texts and images from the Old Testament, that it's drawing on that images of nations swirling in rebellion against the Lord. But bigger question is the one you asked. How can they be that deceived to do it? Well, this is why it's going to happen. In my view, and we could have a different view about Gog Magog, what it's talking about in the future. But again, I believe it's before the millennial kingdom, and this is just imagery that's being drawn on from Ezekiel 38 and 39 here in Revelation 20. But here's the key thing. Why let this happen at all? Why let Satan loose one more time? My understanding, Dwayne, is that this is God's ultimate way of vindicating his righteousness and exposing human sinfulness. Because we always say, well, there's so much suffering in the earth, or God's so distant, or how can I really know? And I would follow God, but if not for this or that. Well, God's going to remove every excuse. There's going to be a time of peace and universal knowledge of the glory of God like the world has never seen, a time when the beauty of the Lord will be beheld, when the power of God will be known, and still people will rebel. People will want to go against God. That's the final exposing of the sin of human nature and the folly of deception and Satan's last hurrah in that sense before his final destruction and the destruction of those that follow him. But to me, this is the final way where God's going to say, here, even in a perfect world, you still choose sin. Even in a world without the problem of suffering and all these other issues, without God hiding himself, you still choose sin. Hey, Dwayne, great questions. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let me keep going here. We go to Iowa. Patty, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. have a question about the Feast of Tabernacles.
Yeah.
First of all, how do you see the main purpose of the Feast of Tabernacles? I understood it was to look forward to the coming kingdom. Is that correct?
Well, it begins in the Old Testament with a looking back. It begins with a looking back to when the children of Israel had to live in tents, had to live in booths in their time in the wilderness. That's one. Yes. Secondly, it is also a time when you remember human frailty, and the wilderness wanderings point to that, hence the reading of Ecclesiastes during that time. Thirdly, as we see by the laws and numbers and the numbers of bulls that are sacrificed, you end up with 70 sacrificial animals over a period of days, which was taken as symbolic of the nations. So that speaks of the end time harvest of the nations. And Zechariah 14 speaks of all nations coming to Jerusalem, the survivors of the nations that attacked Israel, coming to Jerusalem to worship God in the Feast of Tabernacles. And it's possible that Revelation 11, which mentions palm trees in the hands of the multitude that no one can number, it's possible that also ties in with the celebration of tabernacles as well. So it looks back to our wandering in the wilderness, reminds us of the frailty of life, the transitory nature of life, and it looks forward to the final ingathering of all the nations coming to worship the one true God in Jerusalem.
Okay, so it's kind of a climactic thing.
Or yep.
Like where they were in the wilderness and they were trying to get to the promised land. And finally, this is the entrance into the promised land. And is that the last day when they celebrate that?
Yeah. Well, no, they don't really celebrate the entrance into the promised land as much as they celebrate the goodness of God and his covenant with Israel, etc. So it doesn't have that sense of we're out of the wilderness, we're in the promised land. The Passover deliverance, that is when you think next year in Jerusalem, final regathering of the Jewish people. But Tabernacles, for most Jews, is more of a looking back with some anticipation of the Messianic age. From the perspective and the fullness of the cross, there's a looking forward to the climax of the ages. Hey, thank you for your questions, 866-34-TRUTH. If you'll go to AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org. Click on the digital library and search for Tabernacles. So AskDrBrown.org, click on the digital library, and you'll get a show where I talk about insights into Tabernacles. All right, time for one last question. In Dallas, Texas, David, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown.
Hey.
My question is when King David was ruling, his son Jeroboam was trying to take over and running him all over the place. So my question is what was Solomon at this time? I'm trying to put this thing together and figure out where he was at.
Now, which son of David were you saying was trying to take over?
Wasn't it his son Jeroboam? Am I pronouncing
that right? No. Jeroboam comes later. Jeroboam is the one who wrenches the 10 tribes from Rehoboam, Solomon's son. What you're thinking, though, is in 1 Kings, the first chapter. Because of David's many wives, therefore there were different problems in terms of different ones claiming that they had the right to lead the nation, all right? So it references Adoniah Adonijah and one of the sons that wanted to rule and reign. So if you will go to 1 Kings chapter 1, 1 Kings chapter 1, you'll get this all sorted out. All right, 1 Kings chapter 1, you'll find your answer. Hey, friends, there's still time. We have extended registration for our trip to Israel, the trip of a lifetime. Everything is first class, the accommodations, you don't fly over in first class, otherwise we have to charge tens of thousands for the trip, but everything first class, the great hotels, fabulous tour, meetings every night, it's going to be glorious. Time to sign up now, AskDrBrown.org on the homepage.